It's time for a fresh take on entrepreneurship. Financial advisor Justin Klein with entrepreneur Mike Brown. This is Talking Ventures.
Good morning and welcome to Talking Ventures. I am your host, Justin Klein. I am the Executive Vice President of KVP Financial, and I am here with my co-host for the week, entrepreneur Mike Brown. He is the co-founder and founder, or CEO and co-founder of ModBargains.com. Now, both of our companies are located here locally in Orange County, California. And each week we discuss the business trends that affect us all and shed some light, hopefully, on the secrets to creating and sustaining a successful business. Now, let's get a quick rundown of the show today, Mike.
Good morning, Justin, and all the listeners out there. Today's show, we're going to be talking about cash flow management, hiring for character first. Then we're going to go into how Amazon is doing their own shipping logistics now. And finally, the feature of our show is our interview with Brittany Castro, the founder and CEO of Financially Wise Women. It's going to be a great show today, Justin.
It is going to be a great show. I'm excited for it. And let's jump right in. We're going to begin with something we all love, cash.
Yeah.
Don't we all love cash?
Cash is king is the cliche.
That is, especially in my business, you know, cash is king.
Yeah.
And
you like customers that have cash?
Yes.
Yeah, it's needed to invest.
It's needed, yeah. Yeah, you got to have capital to invest. And, you know, we're going to talk a little more specifically about cash flow, which is even better because that means not only do you have cash today, but you have cash going forward, hopefully.
Yeah, it's better and it's often overlooked and misunderstood by entrepreneurs especially.
Yeah, it's vital to the health and sustainability of any business, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a lot of startups now that are burning cash, have a lot of negative cash flow, but that can only go on for so long, right?
Yeah, there's that fake cash bubble type of environment that happens a lot.
Yeah, I'm a value type investor, so I kind of stay away from those companies that are hemorrhaging cash, like a Tesla. But let's focus on, you know, a lot of them focus on the products and they don't focus on the business.
Right.
And cash flow is big. So obviously, Mike, you run a business with millions of dollars in inventory, millions of dollars in sales every month. Which means there's a lot of cash moving around to suppliers, employees, software vendors, merchant accounts, bank accounts. So what is the biggest cash flow challenge you've seen and how has that evolved over the last 12 years?
I mean, you know, you've mentioned it already. It's inventory. So much of our growth is leveraged by inventory. And that's kind of old school, but it's actually one of our competitive advantages is when we have product and our competitors do not because they haven't invested cash flow into inventory.
Mm-hmm.
So the biggest challenge there is as the business grows, so does the inventory with it. So to be honest with you, the biggest challenge sometimes is how do I get money out of the company to pay myself? Or how do we increase hiring and increase...
Your working capital is high.
Yes, yeah. It is.
And I'm sure you also get better terms from your suppliers, right? When you buy a lot as opposed to just a little bit.
Yeah, typically. And terms are based on how the economy is going and how secure they feel in their own financials. Because when the recession hit, a lot of people stopped paying their bills and suppliers completely cut terms and said everything is COD.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, terms are very flexible, especially for a company like us that's been in business for 12 years.
They have a lot of confidence in the economy and you to sell it as opposed to, you know, there might be other businesses that they ship their products to. And they may not sell it, and so they may not get paid for months, right?
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, imagine that as a retailer, a new manufacturer comes out that has a great new product and says, hey, we really think that Mod Bargains is positioned well to sell this new, you know, suspension line of that lowers the cars. And we're like, great. Tell us about it. We learn about it. We start selling it. Maybe we sell like 5 or 10, kind of one at a time, drop shipping straight from the manufacturer to the customer or to our shop for the installation. And then we go, hey, this is a good brand. We should buy 50 of them.
Mm-hmm.
So we have them on the shelf ready to go, and it gives us an advantage. We don't have wait times. When customers walk into the store, we can basically have it there, impulse buy.
You got to have it to sell it.
Now, if that each one of those kits is $1,000 and you buy 50, that's $50,000 sunk into that brand, invested into that brand.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, cash flow.
So what happens if, say, you buy 50 and you sell over months, you sell 45 of them and you have five left and a new model comes out, a new version of it comes out? What happens with the five?
Typically, with the position that we're at with vendors now, we say we're returning these five to you. Mm-hmm. You can do what you want with them. We want to replace with current inventory.
Gotcha.
And they tend to say yes.
And that's mainly because of your heft and size. Smaller vendor probably wouldn't.
They wouldn't have the inventory to begin with.
Oh, got you.
So they wouldn't even be in that position because they're selling one at a time.
Yeah.
So yeah, when inventory becomes irrelevant, that is a risk, but you tend to try to negotiate that in advance.
Now, how difficult is it to forecast your business, and what have you learned over the years? Are there new software tools that have come on that help you do that?
I mean, I wish that we had like automatic forecasting and those types of things built into our business. We're still a little bit, not there technology wise in order for it to just say, bing, here, Mike,
bing,
order this.
I like it.
So it's more of a paying attention type of software.
Yeah. Now, you talked a little bit about payment terms, right? How you, because of the size of your inventory and the economy being good, you have better payment terms. So how different is that from supplier to supplier, and how important is it to get good payment terms?
It's extremely different. You're talking about a one-to-one unique conversation with all new accounts that get set up.
Yeah. And you deal with how many brands?
About 150 that we keep in stock.
Wow.
So those are, yeah, it's a lot of, it's why, I've honestly been really thinking that we've grown to the point where we can now justify having a purchasing manager to take that off my plate and off Ron's plate as well.
Yeah.
But that means that person needs to eventually have return on investment. So with these vendors, I mean, the small ones usually want COD because they don't understand terms and they're like, oh, can you pay me with PayPal or...
Well, and they're probably having cash flow issues as well, right?
Yeah. The larger companies are usually more like, hey, fill out our credit terms paperwork. We'll give you like net 7, which means that you pay like once per week.
And that probably means they have good credit terms with their bank or, because of their heft. We're a smaller supplier. They might not have the revenue and earnings base to really get a large line of credit from a bank.
Yeah. And then on the bigger orders where you go $50,000, $100,000 orders and up with companies you're doing business with for multiple years, you can go net 60, 90, 120 even.
Yeah. Now, what about on the other side for customers? That's cash flow going out, right? Because you got to pay for product. What about collecting from customers? I mean, you pretty much get them out front, right?
We're credit card, cash, check, that kind of stuff. So yeah, we've never had accounts receivable, which is a great thing.
Yeah. But there are some businesses that do, a lot of businesses that do.
And from my perspective, I know the companies that would have accounts receivable issues, it's usually the number one cause of it is because they're not organized on their initial invoicing. Mm. Their invoicing is disorganized. They're slow. And sometimes we'll have one of our vendors, I know them very specifically, they'll be like, oh, we got behind on invoicing. Here's 6 months worth of invoices. And we're like, oh, okay. Yeah, great. So, and then our perspective on that with some of the invoices slow is that it's okay for us to pay them slow. So they've set that precedent. So we're like, all right, here you go. Here's a little.
Taking you 6 months? Well, it's going to take us 6 months to pay you.
Exactly. Yeah. They won't even know because they're so disorganized.
Now, you talked about payment terms. How disciplined are you on making sure you payment terms for people out there that don't know? If you pay by a certain time, usually you get a discount, right?
Yeah.
Of some sort. How hard is that to keep track? And are you very disciplined in that?
Yeah, I mean, the most common one there is net 30 with a 2% discount if you pay it within the first 10 days of receiving the invoice. That's two net 30. And that is really internally for us, that requires us to be disciplined on opening the mail fast enough or opening emails fast enough to look at the invoices and then make the payment.
Yeah.
It's very common, and a lot of companies don't take advantage of it. We also put a lot of our payments on an American Express card that we get 2% cash back on. Mm. And a lot of vendors like the credit card because they don't have to necessarily have accounts receivable. So they basically hit the card right when they ship the product.
Yeah.
But for us, we still get that 2% payment discount.
Well, they better have good margins if they're paying that credit card processing fee.
Yeah, they're around 2.5% probably on American Express as a company. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So overall, cash flow management, did you ever find, I'm sure early on, you probably didn't think about that too much, right?
No.
You know, was there a certain moment, anything that happened, or a level of business that made you go, wow, I gotta really manage all of this cash flow coming in and out?
Nothing will wake up an entrepreneur when, like, the time when they cannot write themselves a paycheck. Mm. But the business is doing great.
Yeah, you're putting your money all back into the business, and because you don't have good cash flow management skills, you aren't able to access any of that capital.
That is the breaking point for a lot of different entrepreneurs, is when they go, forget this. I can't even write myself a paycheck, and I'm working the hardest, yeah, and the company looks great, and yeah, then they have this emotional kind
of reaction. You're working 60, 70 hours a week on this business, and I get no monetary value out of it.
That's when it was an educational process for Ron and myself to basically look at it and go, okay, let's get a handle on this and figure out what is going on.
So all entrepreneurs should be focused on cash flow.
Yeah.
All right, well, we're going to go to a quick break, and after the break, we're going to get to Mike's Entrepreneur Focus segment.
Talking Ventures with financial advisor Justin Klein and entrepreneurs Vince Vitale and Mike Brown on KX93.5 Laguna Beach.
All right, now we are back, and we're going to get into Mike's Entrepreneur Focus segment. And each show, he discusses the real-world topics that he is experiencing as an entrepreneur in his own life. So, Mike, what is your topic today?
Justin, today we're talking about hiring. So recently, my friend Jay Houlihan, who was also a previous guest here on Talking Ventures, we kind of recalled a quote that he's kind of coined, and he said that, hire for character first, energy second, and competency third. So I'm going to break down the three. And the interesting thing to me about that quote is so many entrepreneurs actually do it backwards.
Mm-hmm. Focus they on go, competency first.
Competency first, even in the job posting. Mm. If you think about job and descriptions and postings, it's always
you gotta
about
have,
competency.
You got to have this much experience. You got to have this level of education, et cetera.
Yeah, so he's saying even in the posting, when you're recruiting people, go with character first. Talk about what you're looking for.
We want somebody who's honest. Isn't that kind of a given, though?
It is, but you can be more specific.
Okay.
You can be more, you can talk about brand values. You can talk about core values of the company. You can talk about positioning.
Okay.
And the ways, and then that's going to attract the right type of character more often than not. So let's break down character. This is often the hardest one to ask questions about, because in a job interview, you essentially have, you know, two people sitting across from each other, making themselves look as great as possible, both the company and the person trying to get the job.
Of course.
And it's essentially a relationship, you know, founded on putting your best foot forward that's not always 100% accurate about how you actually are as a person.
You're saying both sides are acting a little bit.
Absolutely. Both sides are acting, making themselves look like they're better than they actually are.
Yeah.
And that is a problem, and that is why a lot of employment relationships do not work out, because people are just not.
So how do you get through that? I mean, obviously everyone's going to come in there and try to put their best foot forward.
Yeah.
What, you know, how do you know that somebody has good character, is somebody that you can trust within your business?
To me, character, when I've been at my best evaluating character, it's about asking other people about the candidate. Doing a really
background checks,
due diligence process.
Do you really call their references?
When I've been at my best, yes. How often do employers that are hiring somebody actually call the references, especially entrepreneurs? Very, very rarely.
But even the references, you know, usually the references are going to be favorable as well, because they're going to pick people they know like them, right?
Well, and a lot of employers are very scared about giving an honest reference, because you could actually be sued by a past employee if you say something that is harsh against them.
Mm.
So there's that risk as well. So in a lot of references, it's very dry. It's just, what was the employee's start date? What was their end date? Okay, what did they do there? Did they ever have blah, blah, blah? Did you ever have to write them up?
Like, so did you ever call a previous employer and they said all the right things, but you just got that vibe that they weren't really telling you the truth, so you didn't hire them?
Yes.
Yeah.
And there is kind of this this vibe that owner to owner employers can give in the way that they give references, where they're basically like, "Yeah, he worked here. Yeah, he's all right.
He's all right.
And that gives off the vibe.
It means
right? Correct. It means be careful. It means like the person could have changed the person, but I didn't have a good relationship as that person's boss.
Yeah. Yeah. I gotcha. And then energy. How do you know somebody's going to have good energy? Like you said, it's a competency can, especially in today's world where you kind of need to have some sort of a bachelor degree, some sort of education, right? You can't, it's hard to get a good job now walking in and saying, I just graduated from high school, an actual a job. So how do you get beyond that and say, okay, they might have graduated from college, but do they have the energy to really bring something positive to this company?
I've started to kind of form a little bit of an opinion of people that are visiting and interviewing. Mm-hmm. We give them a walk around tour of the buildings. We have three different, buildings that are in the complex. And I pay attention to something like, how fast do they walk? Like, are they walking at the same speed as me, or are they a slow walker? Mm-hmm. Are they a slow talker? Mm-hmm. That type of slow energy usually is an indicator of, more tepid performance.
What about also their attention to what you're talking about, their excitement about the different things that you're discussing?
Yeah, body language, the look in their eyes when you ask them certain questions. Are they excited? Are they enthusiastic?
Are they asking questions
back? You can tell if somebody's, depressed. Yeah. You can tell if somebody is in a down state of mind, and if that's their natural default and they can't even get up for an interview,
that's going to bring a lot of negative energy to the business.
Yeah. Good luck after 3 months after their probation period of getting them to have positive energy if they can't even have it in the interview.
Yeah.
So you look for that. You really pay attention to it, and you wouldn't be paying attention to it unless you've gotten past this third one, which everybody asks all the questions about, which is competency. Mm-hmm. And the fact of the matter is that entrepreneurs and employers are usually not looking at character and energy because they've designed their 10 interview questions all around competency.
Now, going back to Ron, right? Your partner, business partner. So I'm sure there's a lot of entrepreneurs out there that are looking for a partner. Maybe they have a partner. Maybe they're thinking about partnering up with somebody to start a business. How did you know Ron had the energy and the character as well as the competency to really partner with him and make something big like you have?
I was 19 and he was 24. we weren't really speaking in these terms back then. I didn't have
like... But looking back, did you...
Talking Ventures didn't exist back then for me to listen.
To hash this out? Yeah.
I guess we got lucky because we've been partners for 12 years and we both have character, energy, and competency. Mm-hmm. I actually think that these tenets kind of apply more the higher up you go. So this applies the most when you're choosing a partner. Mm-hmm. It applies, as well, really, when you're choosing C-level executives. Mm-hmm. And then down the line, I think that as you get to, entry-level positions, it absolutely still applies.
Yeah, because all this filters down to the people below them.
Yeah, but if you're hiring a CEO as like a board member and you're not looking at character, that's a huge, huge risk to be gambling with.
Yeah. It makes a lot of sense. Well, we're going to go to a quick break, and after the break, we're going to talk about our InvestTalk review segment and Amazon.
Talking Ventures with financial advisor Justin Klein and entrepreneurs Vince Vitale and Mike Brown on KX93.5 Laguna Beach.
All right, now we're going to move on to the type of topic that I discuss on my other radio show, Invest Talk, which airs every weekday from 4 to 5 p.m. in Silicon Valley, and also podcasts on iTunes as well, just like this show does, Talking Ventures. Now, on Invest Talk, callers call in to ask questions about the capital markets, the economy, real estate, investing, retirement, etc. And today we're going to discuss one of the most disruptive companies in the e-commerce space, which, Mike, you know very well, and that is Amazon. You're kind of your enemy, your frenemy?
I'm just so confused at that point. It's just they've evolved so much. Yeah, Amazon is huge. Obviously, the market leader in e-commerce. Over a quarter of e-commerce transactions are through Amazon. So, yeah.
Yeah, so they're hefty. Right?
Yeah.
They're hefty. So, and because of their heft, Amazon is leasing 40 767s to start their own air freight service. They also bought 4,000 truck trailers to, you know, help deliver the goods. And apparently UPS, FedEx, the U.S. Postal Service, they can't handle the volume of a quarter of all web transactions.
Is that what they're saying? They can't handle the volume?
Well, yeah, basically.
No? Okay. Here's my gut reaction to this, having interfaced with Amazon a lot over the past decade.
You've interfaced with them a lot?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you go to SEMA, and Amazon is basically hosting meetings with retailers like us saying, hey, become a third-party merchant, and here's how we'll do it. We'll fast-track you, give us your data sheets, and we'll make it really easy for you.
Did you think about it?
We did it.
You did it?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Okay. It didn't work out for us.
No, why?
Lack of profit margins and lack of the ability inside of their Amazon format to educate customers enough about the product to get them to order the right product.
Gotcha. So Amazon steals your profit margins.
That, and if you sell enough of something as a third-party merchant, what do you think Amazon's going to do, Justin?
They're going to do it themselves.
Yes.
And they already have the Amazon Basics, right?
Yes. You know, this is what Amazon is doing with shipping now. If they pay enough and they see enough volume, they say, how do we figure out how to do that ourselves and make more money doing it?
Yeah.
So as a retailer that ships a ton of products, I do hundreds of thousands of dollars in UPS shipping per year.
Amazon does billions.
Yeah. I mean, I just got an email from UPS yesterday that said, hey, heads up, in 2017, we're increasing ground rates by 4.9%. I did the math on that, tens of thousands of dollars. I'm like, okay, that's kind of a big deal. It's 4.9% doesn't sound big, but it is.
But when you do hundreds of thousands of dollars in
so
in
I don't
business.
Think it's about, UPS can't handle the volume. Under peak times like Black Friday and Cyber Monday, there's a lot
of stress.
That's
what they're more talking about is actually during the Christmas season.
Oh, it's just a segue into doing it all their own all the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Once they get a taste of it, they're going to scale it up. That's what Amazon does. It's what they're great at.
Yeah, and this is very similar, I think, to their Amazon Web Services business that they have, which is now an $8 billion business in and of itself. They built that to really support their Amazon Prime digital services like Amazon Video, and they have the music service, and they have the books. They have a book service as well.
Yeah.
So they built that for themselves, and they built so much capacity, they decided to sell off that capacity, cloud capacity, to other businesses, and it's grown dramatically, and it's actually one of their biggest profit drivers. So you think that's the road they're going down?
Yeah. I really think that they're going to become more profitable by doing their own deliveries.
So maybe you will be using Amazon to ship your products.
Maybe. I think it's a ways off where they would actually reach out to us and then come and pick things up from us. I think that's a whole different ballgame. What they're looking at doing is going straight from an Amazon warehouse straight to the customer. Because there's no the way they're looking at it, it's like, why do we have this giant triangle of from us to UPS and then to the customer? Like they're like, that doesn't make sense. It's just going to slow it down by a day, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're paying a lot of money to them. So like, why don't we just go from us in a truck with all the different distribution warehouses they already have and the reach that they have, and then use UPS, FedEx, and USPS for the ones that they can't reach?
Well, I think this is kind of the bigger picture I see is Amazon Now, right? It's our delivery, two-hour delivery. I used it a couple weeks ago for a few things. And they have different hubs around the country, I think 70-something, to where it covers certain regions where you can get two-hour delivery.
Does it cover Laguna Beach?
It does, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Their hub is in Irvine, so they just come down the canyon and,
And
so,
is it limited to certain types of items?
Yeah, yeah. Amazon Now is definitely...
Can't get a TV in 2 hours?
It's more about selection.
Okay.
You can actually, I wouldn't say it's limited to the type of items. It's limited to the number of items. So
you can probably get like a Kindle Fire or something like that, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And you could, I got a notepad book, for writing notes. And there was only one of those, right? So you can't go and find 20 of them and pick the one you really like. You get one option for, you know, for 2 hours.
I think
the
reality on Amazon these days is you only look at one or two, maybe three items in a category before you look
and
at
it. I'm sure they pick the one that, you know, they sell the most and has the highest ratings, et cetera.
Yeah, you're like, this one has, you know, 4.5 stars and 2,500 reviews. Why do I need to look at five more?
Exactly. So, what I see is them just basically they're going to eventually, like you said, use all these 767s to deliver the products to these warehouses and deliver it themselves, because that's what they're already doing with Amazon now.
Yeah. You know? It's not that big of an investment for them to kind of dabble in this space. In order to scale it up to a daily national level, that's a much bigger investment. And UPS and FedEx have huge, huge infrastructures, and the post office in and of itself. So it makes sense. It's what they do.
Yep.
You know, when Amazon came out, they didn't stock jewelry in their warehouse. Now they do, because they're like, that's profitable. That makes sense for us to do it.
And they deliver a lot of items. This year, it's estimated they're going to deliver 7.2 billion items.
That's
Can you even wrap your head around that?
I had to take a breath, because numbers. But it's so massive.
Yeah. And I think by 2020, the estimate is 12 billion items by 2020.
I believe it.
So obviously Amazon or Walmart, Target, they see this as a threat, right? Because why, if you can get anything on Amazon in 2 hours, which I think is eventually their goal, why would you need to run to Target and run to Walmart? So Walmart bought Jet.com for $3 billion. I mean, is that... Did they see the writing on the wall?
Yeah. The writing has been there for some time.
Yeah.
And that's why you've seen these big box stores start to invest into more e-commerce on their own, invest into or try to adjust their stores to be smaller, and move into different product categories that they can find more profit margins in.
More niche categories, like what you do. You're a niche category.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I haven't seen Walmart go into like selling the
rims.
Same. Yeah, right.
They might have some rims and spinners there.
I've seen some type of automotive, like chrome hubcaps and stuff like that walking down the aisles, but nothing like
what we do. Yeah. Nothing like what you do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be very interesting to see where Amazon goes with this investment, and, you know you're going to hear more about it. So we're going to go to a quick break. And after the break, we're going to interview Brittany Castro.
Talking Ventures with financial advisor Justin Klein and entrepreneurs Vince Vitale and Mike Brown on KX93.5 Laguna Beach.
All right, now we'd like to welcome our guest for this week, Brittany Castro. She is the founder and CEO of Financially Wise Women. Welcome, Brittany.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming down.
Yeah, it's pretty early for me.
A little early?
You're not up
for the markets?
I get up early, but, you know, to make the drive down. Yeah. But you guys are
on a Saturday, we're overachieving right now. Yeah,
we are winning in life.
We are winning. That's the goal, right?
Yeah.
Now it's always great to get an entrepreneur in here in studio who works in my field, right? And you are an RIA, which for everybody out there, it's a registered investment advisor. And I am one
Thanks. I didn't know that, so I appreciate that.
Did you not know?
I wouldn't know what those letters mean. Okay. No. Well, I just know you guys understand money.
Fancy terms we like to use in the financial industry.
Yeah. The SEC... spits them out at us, so we got to use them.
Got any other three-letter acronyms?
Oh, yeah, there's plenty. There's
lots of them.
Yeah. So, you know, can you talk a little bit about how you got into this field and what made you want to go out on your own and kind of create your own brand as opposed to kind of hiding underneath a bigger brand?
Right. So I actually got started in the career right after college. I studied business economics at UC Santa Barbara. Go Gauchos.
All right.
And... it was kind of just one of those things. I got a job offer at Ameriprise Financial, and I came back to Long Beach and took the job and started at that company and was there for about 5 years. And it was, I think, at a great time in the industry where there was a lot of training and marketing and money being poured into those programs, especially at Ameriprise. So I feel fortunate in the sense that I was able to get a lot of that knowledge early on in my career, how to run a business, how to give financial advice, have really good mentors and managers kind of coach me through. And after about 5 years there, I realized I'm not really made for corporate America. You know, I'm way too entrepreneur and creative to be limited by the rules and regulations that go into that.
And there are a lot of rules and regs, especially for those big brokerage firms.
Yeah. And so I felt that it was a good time in my life and career. It was still early to figure out, okay, how do I continue in the industry, but do it in a way that makes sense for me and that feels
more freedom.
More freedom. Yep. I'm going to throw out the cliche word, more authentic to me and who I am and not, you know.
You started to feel that itch to break free of being constrained inside of the corporation. You wanted to kind of have your own way of doing things. And now your company, Financially Wise Women, clearly targets women. So, you know, tell us about what makes marketing to women different and also why you chose to go with that type of marketing and that type of approach.
Yeah, so basically being a woman myself in the industry, I always felt alone when I'd go to events and conferences. And I just started to see the opportunity in the marketplace to educate women and work with women who are out there working, making money, handling the household finances, but just do it in a way that was more relaxed and more casual, as if women were going to lunch as friends, and I happened to know the money, and I was just educating on them about that. And I think women ultimately are underserved in the financial space just because it is still very male-dominated. I mean, less than 20% of the financial planners and advisors are women. So I think it's not necessarily a different strategy, but just how you talk about it, that's different for women.
Yeah, and I've seen some of your interviews and your content, and so much of it is just it's on the fundamentals, and it's very professional but casual all at the same time. And I think that that's, to me, as an outsider looking in on this industry, it's pretty unique because it's kind of intimidating to like go into like a meeting with a financial planner. You're like, oh, this person knows a lot and they're gonna judge me.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of like there's that wall, that barrier. So do you feel like your marketing has kind of, you know, smash that wall a little bit?
Definitely. And it's evolved over time. Like, I actually had to get comfortable and unwind a lot of the compliance limitations.
There's a lot of compliance.
There's a lot. And it took me, and I'm still learning how to be just me, deliver the advice, be an expert, but also just be normal about it. Mm-hmm. Not like be all stuffy and uptight and talk down to people, because whoever wants to be talked down to, whether you're a man or a woman. And so I think in terms of the casualness, it's really helped me just communicate maybe the fundamentals that people feel like they should know and judge themselves for not knowing, and then therefore they feel like they're going to be judged by asking a question. I mean, all these weird things that we do with money, I just try to eliminate that so people feel more relaxed, more comfortable, and know that they're not alone.
Right.
Now you might talk a little bit about, you know, you have a blog and you create a lot of video content. So can you talk a little about like your digital marketing strategy and what you do to really leverage technology in your own practice?
Yes. So I started my YouTube channel. Okay. After Ameriprise Financial, I went to LPL Financial, and it was an independent firm. So I really started to push social media, and I would call my compliance officer like every day and say, here's what I want to do. I need a way to do it. And I started the YouTube channel because I would see different fashion bloggers and beauty bloggers. And all of a sudden, this was like when it like really started to take off, like people leveraging social media to build a brand, a platform. And a lot of the women I saw would watch, you know, like I'm a woman, I would watch their stuff, I would read their blog. So I thought, oh, well, if I could do that with money, that would be ideal. So I started the YouTube channel, and like my first videos are super awkward. Definitely
it
more
takes some
stale.
Getting used to. Yeah.
And then slowly I think I launched the Twitter and the Facebook, working with LPL to get those things approved. And then after 2.5 years at LPL, I left and started my own RIA, which is where ultimately I feel like
So now you're completely independent.
I'm completely independent. And that's really when a lot of my social media started to pick up. And I created all these systems to be posting regularly and getting content out there.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to be independent nowadays than it used to be.
It is. So, but it still takes a lot of work.
It does. Yeah. I mean, I'm independent as well. Yeah.
But it is definitely easier.
Yeah. It's definitely easier. I mean, we have a compliance consultant that we use that helps us decide what's compliant for, for the SEC. Right. And that's difficult. You know, their rules and their regs are kind of nebulous. They don't really give you defined rules. They kind of give you suggestions and, you know, kind of guidelines, but it's not really that specific. But luckily, you know, I've been doing radio for over a decade now, so I kind of understand the ins and outs, but that changes a lot. So it's challenging.
I think all those regulations kind of speak to the problem that Brittany's trying to solve, because there's an opportunity for people in your position to take advantage of uneducated consumers that are just trying to plan their retirement and have good financial habits. So I think that all of those regulations that you see are because somebody did something wrong.
Yep.
Well,
I think it's the bigger firms.
Though. And it's the two, like people like yourself, Justin and Brittany, that you guys have the right spirit about. And you're like, hey, I want to come in and do financial planning to help people and solve this problem that not everybody has always had in financial planning, and that's why there's so many hurdles to jump over. That's my take as an entrepreneur looking in.
Definitely. And I also think technology has changed the game, because really with technology and social media, these platforms weren't around, whatever, 10 years ago is when, you know, Facebook started to like really become popular. But just from 10 years to now, like social media and blogs, I mean, it's almost the norm. And if you don't have it, it's weird.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of those, like with the restrictions and finding a way to overcome the restrictions, but then leveraging technology to get your message out there and get clients, this is the way we do business. Mm-hmm. So
now, there is a hurdle in our industry, I think, when it comes to technology, is that our target demo is older, right? Our target demo is 40 plus, probably 50 plus, because they're the ones that have the money typically, right? So how do you kind of overcome that? I mean, I'm sure you have a lot of followers that are younger, but those aren't really usually the great target clients, right? Because they're starting to build their wealth, and you can help them with that, but it's usually small because they're not making a lot of money. You know, they're still trying to buy a house. They're trying to get to where, you know, most people are in their 50s. So how do you overcome that hurdle of your target demo being kind of older?
Actually, my target demographic is not older.
Really? Okay.
I target people in their 30s and 40s, and I'm very clear about that. And the reason is all the other financial advisors are going after the people in their 50s and 60s and 70s. And I always thought, well, that doesn't make sense, because I'm in my 30s. So if I'm going to be targeting clients who are older than me, then ultimately 10, 20 years from now, I'm going to have to rebuild my whole business if I don't get them to keep the money with the kids and get the kids. So I thought, actually, the opportunity for me is to go after people in my demographic, speak to them in a way that's empowering and uplifting, help them accumulate the wealth, help them manage the wealth along the way, and we all grow together.
It sounds like you're in this for life. You're basically here, and you're like, this. I know that this is what I want to do. I want to establish lifelong relationships with my clients and then grow with them.
Exactly. And also, too, It was such an opportunity for me. Like, why would I go? This is why I think niche marketing and being very clear about who you're going after becomes part of success, the success strategy. I'm very clear about who I target, and I'm not the person for the baby boomers or, you know what I mean, the people who my company is called Financially
you're,
Wise.
Yeah,
women,
you're honest. You're honest.
I'm honest.
Yeah,
who
you're
I
honest.
Want
you're
as
honest with you're honest with your target. Right?
Yeah.
You're not trying to fake it. Right. You're okay with focusing on the 30 and 40 year olds, and you're doing you're maximizing that as
exactly.
opposed. And that might be a little harder than targeting 50 and 60 year olds, but. You know, like you said, you're in it for life, which is
yeah. And
a good
I don't
strategy.
Know if it's harder. I feel like that whole thing is relative. For me, it's actually easier. Mm-hmm. But I do have a very unique business model. I'm not a traditional RIA.
Yeah.
Like I get paid to speak. I have paid consulting agreements and brand spokesperson deals. So my vision has always been to build the the company and the brand to be beyond financial planning. That's one piece of my business, and it's definitely something I enjoy, but I have an online product, I have speaking, I have consulting. So I've always had this idea and goal to build it to be like a lifestyle brand that could maybe eventually be beyond just clients.
Diversifying revenue stream, yeah, which I think is big too. I know I'm doing the same thing. You know, we're creating different robo-advisor products and doing things that kind of diversify our revenue stream. And I think that is something I think every business needs to understand, right? Is if you are focused on one way to make money, you know, that can always change, whether there's disruption in the industry or, you know, the economy goes down or whatever. I think having different revenue streams at that to pivot to in tough times is very important, don't you?
Yeah, very important. Yeah.
All right, we're going to go to a quick break. And after the break, we're going to have more with Brittany Castro.
Talking Ventures with financial advisor Justin Klein and entrepreneurs Vince Vitale and Mike Brown on KX93.5 Laguna Beach.
All right, now we are back with Brittany Castro, and now you are in the investment world, Brittany, and you're young, especially for our industry, just like I am, and I know you know my partner's in his 60s. He does a lot of the meetings because, like I said, he's you know, our target demo tends to be older. Do you ever battle against that reverse discrimination where you talk to somebody who's in their 50s and 60s, and they just think, you don't know what you're talking about because you're in your 30s.
I used to a lot. I really don't care anymore,
yeah,
to be honest. Well, I'm like, I don't know.
You don't
like, what do you want me to do?
You don't try to push against it? Just kind of let them go?
I wish our listeners could see the body language around there. You're just like, I don't care anymore.
Literally, I don't care. No, early in my career, I started when I was 22, and I did. I tried to, like, be older and be more serious so people would take me as a responsible financial advisor. And I remember probably for the good, you know, first 5 years of my career, that was an issue because I let it be an issue.
Yeah.
Like, I was insecure about it. So then I didn't know how to deal with it when clients would ask me. But ultimately what I started to do is just say, yeah, I'm young and I'm going to be around when you retire, which is a lot better than your advisor retiring before you.
That's
and
great.
Then you
use
have
it
to
as
find,
your advantage.
Yeah, I just,
embrace it.
I just pivoted it. And now, to be honest, I'm like, who cares? I am who I am. If you don't like me, move on. I mean, life's too short to really worry. What am I going to do? Pretend I'm 50?
I think in all relationships, you know, that confidence helps.
Yeah.
You know, and like you said, if you are worried about it, it's going to translate and it's going to affect how they view you. But if you're just confident in it and just go with it, you know,
is it kind of common for there to be like a young partner, old partner in, you know, financial advising relationships, like in terms of
I don't know. I mean, that's how I am, but I don't know.
It's actually, I feel like it makes the most sense. But from what I always research and see, it's not the case. I mean, it's really hard. The business succession planning in our industry is not good at all.
Yeah.
Like, advisors don't. They know they need to bring in probably younger advisors to, you know, take over the business or find something to eventually sell the business. But the reality is it's not happening like we would think it would.
Yeah.
And the barrier to entry in this industry is difficult for young people nowadays. I think unless you have that entrepreneurial spirit to just go for it and go on your own right away.
Yeah.
You kind of have to, like anything, start from the bottom and work your way up in the firm and hope. You know, that
hope and pray.
Hope that
but that's why you're that's why you went independent, right? Because you weren't ready to hope and pray.
No.
Yeah. And I know I read the Financial Advisor magazine, things like that. And there's always business succession articles about it, you know. And luckily for me, I don't have to worry. You know, we don't have to worry about that. And you're right. It is pretty atypical in the industry, but it works the best. Because I know when I'm 50 or 60, I'm going to be looking for somebody young to
smart. Why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
So, Brittany, you operate a service business, and so what benefits and challenges do you see with that versus a product sales business model like mine, where I'm actually selling physical product, you're selling really, you know, your expertise, your consultations and time.
Right.
So I have a little bit of service because we actually do the work on the cars. So we charge labor rates in order to put the, you know, parts on the vehicle. But my main business is sales of product.
Right.
So talk about the differences that you see there.
So that is definitely a challenge and one I was aware of when I started it, because unless I went the very traditional model, the way to scale, I mean, that traditional model, the way you scale is by getting more assets you manage, which is not time for money. You know, you might have the same amount of clients, but they have a bigger nest egg.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, I launched an online course. It's called The Money Class. So if you go to fwwmoneyclass.com, you could see that. It's a 6-week online curriculum. So online products has always been something I've work toward having in my business, because I know that it is time for money. I personally can only deal with so many clients who pay me a consulting service fee, and then I'm strapped, you know.
And that online product is scalable.
Scalable.
Yeah.
So that's what I've been working on pushing for the past 2 years. It's been around. And right now I actually have a really good opportunity to scale this thing with a partner. So That's moving forward where I'm going, because I do like this idea of financially wise women offering financial planning services for clients, but also having so many other products available to them, whether it's an online product. Even I want to launch the brand products, t-shirts, so women are, rocking financial wise women gear, and, the key phrases that I say a lot, but to make money fun and sexy for women, I want, it to be that bigger lifestyle brand.
I like that a lot. You know,
so
where
I'll call you when I'm ready to talk about all the product side of running
inventory
business.
Management
inventory.
Of t-shirts. Yeah, it's fun. Yeah, very fun.
I think that's a great plan, because especially in our industry, everyone respects kind of, for some reason, the bigger firms, right? Morgan Stanley and, B of A and Merrill Lynch, and they see safety in that. But as you know, being in that industry, those are actually some of the worst places that anybody could turn to for financial advice, because there's so much conflict of interest there, right? Whereas us being independent, we don't have that constraint, that conflict of interest, but we also don't have the big brand either. So, building that brand is very important so that people do trust you. So,
right.
Is that the goal? Is that part of the goal?
Exactly. It's part of the goal. And that's exactly why I do so much content.
Mm-hmm.
Like, my goal with my content, I produce weekly videos, emails, I'm pushing out tips on my social media platforms.
Content is king.
Content is queen.
Queen. Oh, there we go.
Queen. Look at that.
Cash is queen.
I've never heard
gentlemen,
that.
Gentlemen.
I love
it. Let me break it down. So I think by providing free value on a regular basis, people begin to see me as a thought leader in the industry, mm-hmm. a trusted resource. I mean, like anything, if you like and trust somebody, you're going to do business with them. And I have I always come back to those core things with my business and what I'm doing, to have integrity with who I am, who I'm trying to help, and ultimately just be of service and constantly give. Even sometimes when you feel like, man, I give so much free stuff away,
mm-hmm.
and people still are going to complain about a fee that they have to pay eventually to work with me one-on-one. It's interesting, right?
Yeah.
How customers and people in general, what we do with money and services,
it's hard
and what
to turn,
we value. And
it's hard to turn
value.
Somebody into, a free, somebody's used to getting things for free and then suddenly got to pay for it. It can be a challenge.
But I
also think that's part of the money teaching that I teach.
You get what you pay for?
Exactly. And if you have a hard time paying for a professional service that you know is going to help you in your life and get you to reach your goals, that's like something's off there, right?
Yeah.
So that's part of it. If you want good money energy and to have wealth and abundance and enjoy money, then you have to be able to pay people and pay them properly for the work and services.
And that's kind of similar to what we do with Invest Talk. We give a free radio show, podcast, and it's 5 days a week, a lot of content.
Yeah.
And people the goal for a lot of people is to do it themselves. But we also realize that eventually people are going to realize they can't do it themselves, right? We're professionals. Yeah. We do it, you know, 5 days a week, 52 weeks out of the year. You know, we're focused on this every day.
And it's about
the
time,
person,
though. I mean, for, time management. Really, yeah. for busy people, it's a lot about time.
It's not just time. It's resources of data of what to buy, why to buy it, how to analyze it, etc. And discipline as well. You know, I think that's big. We focus on discipline a lot in the investment world. You know, discipline, I think, is everything. You know, so many people get caught up in the hype of exciting, ideas and companies, et cetera. And usually when that's the most exciting is usually some of the worst time to invest in it, right? Whereas companies that maybe are down in the dumps, not doing well, I see those as good values and cheap. And that's where you should be allocating money. But most people don't have the discipline to do that, right? So it's a lot of things.
It's a lot of things. I mean, it's money is emotional.
It is.
You know,
fear and greed.
Our role most of the time is just to calm our clients, mm-hmm. remind them of the long-term strategy.
Yeah.
For me, I think one of the biggest values I bring my clients is just holding their hand through the decision so they feel like they're not alone, remind them of what they're doing and why, and take the fear out of it.
It sounds like being authentic is not a challenge for you. I know that we both really enjoy that word because we both are doing things that we're passionate about that we love to do. So, I mean, kind of for the entrepreneurs out there that are listening to the show, because that's the bulk of our listeners, you know, what's the main piece of advice that you would give to them as they look to start their own business or grow their business that they already have?
Yeah, I would say just dive in and try things. I mean, that's really how I became comfortable doing what I'm doing, comfortable in my own skin, not care what others think about what I'm doing.
So have the energy. Goes
back
to
the energy. And it is a commitment to keep going and keep trying and not get, you know,
discouraged.
And look, I've fallen down so many times, and mm-hmm. I think that's just part of it. How many times can you just get back up? And after those things come your way, because challenges are always going to be there.
Get knocked down, get back up, learn uh-huh. something from it, move on, and continue to serve the customer.
Exactly. And I think that just makes you more relatable, more grounded as a person when you just acknowledge, to stay humble along the way.
Mm-hmm.
But life will also help with that. Like, you'll have a high moment in your entrepreneur journey, and then the next day you get an email from whatever it is, uh-huh. right? And it, like, can crush you if you allow it. But that's just the roller coaster of it. And I think for me, I've just been doing it so long now that I think, well, it's part of it.
It's each year that goes by, there's less and less that it'll be the first time you've gone through something.
Right.
But when you start, it's when you go through it, it's always brand new and it's always scary. And it's just like, how am I going to get through this? But then when it happens again, you're like, okay, I got through it this way the last time, but this time I'm going to do it a little bit differently.
And I think those dips, like you talk about the roller coaster of a business, those dips are always learning experiences. You need to take them as learning experiences. And if you do that, the highs will be higher than they were before.
Always.
And I think that's what's key to bouncing back is not just have the energy to bounce back, but also gain some perspective and knowledge so that you can apply that to going forward. So, you know, when things start getting better, you can help avoid the dips, maybe make the highs last a little bit longer. And that is, to me, the entrepreneurship journey is finding those little tips that can just keep that roller coaster going up, even though you have little dips here and there, but it keeps going higher and higher.
Exactly. Right.
You have any tips for any female entrepreneurs in particular?
Female entrepreneurs, don't forget about the money, ladies. You know, that's part of it. Mike, you were talking about that earlier when you and your partner had to figure out the cash flow differently. I think I see a lot of women in general who have the businesses, and I've gone through this myself, where we can get intimidated by asking for more money or going to get that loan or investor money to really grow our companies. I mean, that's something I'm looking at right now. Like, how do I really take this business to the next level? Mm-hmm. I can't do it alone.
Yeah, like, organically. You know,
organically has gotten me this far, which has been amazing, but now I really am opening up to, like, oh, I got to think bigger now.
Yeah.
And I think as a woman, that might not be so, like, I don't know, you guys tell me, but, you know, men to me seem to just, like, go for it, mm-hmm. like, easier. And whereas women...
I'm a little more cautious.
A little bit are like, oh, I don't know, maybe, mm-hmm. but, you know, how's this going to affect my family life, you know, because yeah. we have other things that we want in life too, kids and family. So to try to like balance it all and see the business as a way to bring more of those things that we ultimately want to use our money for has been something that I've learned. Women entrepreneurs can definitely use more advice in that area.
So go for it.
Go for it and don't be afraid of it.
Well, you've definitely... gone for it.
Yeah,
so
thanks.
Congratulations.
Thanks,
and
thank you, Brittany.
I'll be following, seeing how you grow your brand even bigger than it is today.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks,
it's
Brittany.
A pleasure.
Talking Ventures, a fresh take on entrepreneurship, forward-looking ideas about creative business development with financial advisor Justin Klein, with entrepreneur Mike Brown. Contact Justin Klein directly at talkingventures.com and join us again next week for more conversation about emerging trends and the secrets to creating and sustaining a successful business.